At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Weekly. It's Wednesday, September 3rd, 2025. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. We'll hear a report about Halloween Horror Nights 2025. We'll present an interview with the people behind The Roses and talk about that film, and wrap up with the final segment of Brad's Digman Season 2 interview from a few weeks ago. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com. Before we jump into the news, I wanted to address something real quick. Someone pointed me to the fact that we've had a few new reviews on Apple Podcasts lately, which is great, but the people leaving those reviews don't seem fully satisfied with the show. I have had multiple listeners reach out and ask me to change the format back to the way that it used to be. And I will just tell you all, for reasons that are out of my control and above my pay grade, I just cannot do that. I'm sorry. I know a lot of people liked the old format. But I will say, if you're one of the people who misses the box office conversations and the water cooler episodes, you should check out a podcast called Pop Cultured with a D that I do with Brad, Jacob, BJ, and our old friends Peter Serretta and Huai Tran Bui. You can check us out at patreon.com/popcultured. Or we have a free feed on Apple Podcasts. If you just search for Pop Cultured, you should be able to find it there. If you like what you hear, there's a subscription tier where you can hear episodes that are behind a paywall, and there's a tier where you can hear Ryan and I have weekly box office discussions. So come one, come all. We would love to have you listening to us over there, as well as hanging out with us here every week on Slash Film Weekly. And man, somebody else left a comment that kind of got under my skin a little bit. Somebody said that interviews are boring, and I just fundamentally disagree with that. I'm very passionate about doing interviews. Hopefully you all can hear some of that passion come through in the conversations that we have with folks here on the show. But even if we present an interview for a project that you don't like, you can still learn something interesting about the way movies or TV shows are made by listening to one, or you just skip the interview altogether. So yeah, we're still going to be doing interviews. That's going to be a big part of the show moving forward. So I apologize if you hate interviews. But anyway, that's the plug. Patreon.com/popcultured. Check out what we're doing over there. I think you'll really dig it. And let's jump right into the news today. Joining me now to talk about the news, we have Slash Film staff writer Ryan Scott.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
All right, Ryan, good to talk to you. Let's jump right into it. We have a lot to bounce through here today. First up, earlier, this was, I guess, last week, Ryan Gosling's Star Wars movie revealed its full cast and a first look image. The interesting, notable things about this to me were the cast members that we didn't previously know about, which include people like Amy Adams and Aaron Pierre, who starred in Rebel Ridge. So that's pretty rad. I know we've talked a lot about the making of this movie and our varying excitement levels for it. Did this first look photo do anything for you? Are you excited, more excited, less excited after the revelation of this cast?
The photo didn't do much, but it's not intended to, right? They're hiding everything. They're not going to show you anything, but the cast really got me. You know, who doesn't want Amy Adams in a Star Wars movie? Come on. Like, you know, that's pretty cool. So and Aaron Pierre is very much a movie star. And it's a really interesting cast, because there's also some like sort of up and comers in the mix there. You know, Mia Goth is in it. She kind of took the place of, I guess, Mikey Madison, who passed on the movie. You got Matt Smith in there. It's an interesting, you know, but for me, more than anything, is that I like that this is going somewhere new. It's 5 years after the events of Rise of Skywalker. None of those characters are in it, so far as we know. You know, it's kind of trying to do something new with Star Wars, which I'm very much ready for.
Yeah, totally. All right, so next up, I don't want to dig into this deeply. I'm just going to put a link here and encourage people to check that out. But there's another lawsuit against Amazon for effectively trying to scam people into thinking that when you buy a digital movie on Amazon Prime Video, that you actually own that. Because hopefully we've talked about this enough on the podcast over the years that people know this. And I know we've written about it a bunch on Slash Film, but just in case this is the first time you're hearing this news, if you buy a movie digitally from a service like that, whether it's Apple TV Plus or Google Play or Amazon Prime Video, you're basically buying a license to watch that movie for as long as that company holds the rights or has the ability to give it to you. And they can and have just yanked files away from people who have previously purchased them. So naturally, consumers are not thrilled about that. And there's been another, I think this is a class action lawsuit against Amazon in this particular case to try to stop them from doing this kind of thing. So you can read all the details in the article at Slash Film. I just wanted to once again encourage people to seek out physical media. Ryan, have you ever encountered this before? And do you still, I know we've talked about you care a lot about physical media, but do you ever occasionally make a digital purchase these days?
Well, so for me, what I do is a lot of times when you buy, you know, a given movie, you get the digital code to add to like your, you know, Movies Anywhere library or whatever. So I'm big on that. And I think what's weird about that is like even like those licensing agreements change. So like Lionsgate movies don't show up on certain services that collect your digital movie. Like it's just such a,
yeah.
So I engage with it in that way. And yeah, it's just, it's important to understand that you don't own these things, you know, like you only own it insofar as like, as long as that service exists and as long as that contract is in place, and those can go away at any time. It's a lot of the same stuff with music right now too. So I don't know. It's, yeah, I try to not do this for that exact reason. Like I'll rent something knowing I'm probably not going to watch it again. But as far as like making a digital purchase for that reason, I don't really do it because you don't own it.
Yeah, totally. Okay. So moving on real quick, this was notable to me because this is the first time that I'm hearing about this project, but Anthony Ippolito is going to be playing Sylvester Stallone in a Making of Rocky movie for Amazon MGM. The film is called I Play Rocky, and Ippolito is going to be starring as a young Stallone that basically is kind of like a biopic about that period in his life where he wrote the screenplay for the original Rocky movie and was really holding out to be cast as the lead character and was told no a bunch, but ended up betting everything on himself. And obviously we know what happened after that. So I had no idea that this project existed, and I'm not super familiar with Anthony Ippolito as an actor. He is best known for playing Al Pacino in the Paramount Plus show The Offer, which is about the making of The Godfather. So far he seems to have found a niche for playing these guys in the 70s who would become major Hollywood stars. So
famous Hollywood Italians, basically. The Pacino to Stallone pipeline is interesting. I'm trying to think of like a younger Stallone and a younger Pacino now, and I kind of actually see it. It's a bit interesting.
Yeah. So do you have any interest in this movie conceptually? Are you a big Stallone guy? Do you care about the lore around the Rocky franchise? Do you think that's good material for being mined dramatically for a new story?
I mean, I think the thing is, like, obviously I love the Rocky movies. Like, most of them are very good. Rocky V is atrocious, but, like, for the most part, they're great. And, you know, the original Rocky is so good, and it's an American classic. But it's also one that, like, you know, there's that whole thing that Stallone kind of maybe sort of stole the story from that real-life boxer, and he never really got any credit for it. And, you know, so it's like, are they gonna... is this going to be like a really like Bohemian Rhapsody type thing where it's just glitzy and wonderful, and, or are they actually going to try to, you know, really get into what happened with all of it?
Right.
You know, so I'm interested in, but at what level, like it kind of depends on the presentation. Right. But yeah, it's regardless of whatever happens, Stallone's story of getting Rocky made is pretty harrowing. Like, he sold his dog, if I recall correctly, mm-hmm. like, just because he had no money, and he was, like, he'd gotten offers for the script, and decent offers, but he was so committed to, like, it really is, if you don't know anything about it, like, the story of Rocky is fascinating. But, yeah, so it's ripe. It's ripe for, you know, for a movie. I just hope that it's done in, like, a not, you know, glossy Wikipedia way, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Real quick, Cary Elwes has been cast as the President of the United States in FX's series Very Young Frankenstein, which is a prequel to Mel Brooks's Young Frankenstein movie, the classic from the mid-70s. So I just wanted to note that. I think that's fairly good casting. He played, I think it was the mayor of Hawkins, Indiana in Stranger Things season 3, I believe it was. So yeah, the kind of like authority figure position, he seems to be filling that fairly well in this kind of latter era of his career. Mortal Kombat 2 has been delayed to summer 2026, and I know this one kind of bugged you, right?
Well, one, I'm just really excited for the movie. Like, that trailer had me, like, that was exactly what I wanted from that trailer. But it just takes a big movie off the calendar for October that we could really use this year, box office wise. But I also think it's a tremendous amount of confidence. Like, it's a confidence signal from Warner Brothers to be like, no, we want to get this in summer.
They're moving it to May 15th, 2026.
Yeah. So like, that's a confident move. On the one hand, I think that's a good thing, but it does sort of really, it doesn't help the current situation, which is kind of a bummer. But so I just don't want to wait for it. I think it looks like a blast. So I'm, you know, but yeah, so I'm kind of two minds about it, but I don't know. I think maybe due to lack of stiffer competition, maybe they would have fared better in October this year. I don't know. We'll have to see how it plays out, but I get why you do it. If you think you got a good movie and you want to put it in summer, I get it.
All right. So next up, I was surprised to learn that Warner Brothers has picked up the screenplay for a movie called With the Eighth Pick, which is about NBA star Kobe Bryant making his journey to the Los Angeles Lakers. There is no director attached yet, but Alex Sohn and Gavin Johansson wrote the spec script for this. And it is said to focus on the New Jersey Nets and the then general manager of that team, John Nash, who held the eighth pick in the draft and considered taking Kobe Bryant out of high school. And then eventually he would be drafted by the Charlotte Hornets with the 13th pick and was traded to the Lakers and then became like an NBA legend after that. And the project is described as having elements of Moneyball, The Social Network, and Air, the Michael Jordan shoe story. And it's supposed to detail the pivotal process during which slightly different decisions could have changed the NBA's future. Now, Ryan, I know you're a NFL fan. Do you care at all about the NBA? Do you have like a take on Kobe Bryant? Are you interested in the idea of this kind of like almost like a what if type of story being told here?
Okay, so here's the thing. I don't care about baseball as an example, right? Moneyball is one of my comfort movies. Like, sports through the correct cinematic lens, always a good marriage for me. So I'm not particularly interested in the NBA, but I loved Air, for example. So like, the pitch for this movie is interesting. I find it interesting. This is also one of those execution dependent things, right? Like, if they can own up to that, you know, lofty sort of description that was set up there, then that sounds amazing. That sounds way up my alley. So it all depends on how it comes out, but I'm curious about it for sure.
Okay. All right. Next up, Netflix has set a 2-week theatrical window for Wake Up Dead Man, a Knives Out mystery, Rian Johnson's third film in the Knives Out franchise. And I think this was, I think it's probably fair to say that this was largely expected, but it's nice to have official confirmation. So they're releasing it in select theaters on November 26th for a 2-week run until it comes to Netflix on December 12th. So I think that's pretty close to what they did for Glass Onion, right? Or was Glass Onion only a week?
Glass Onion was just a week.
Okay. All right. So this is double that. That's good.
It's I don't know.
It's better than a week.
It is. I just wrote something for us recently that sort of had to do with some of this Netflix theatrical stuff. And it's kind of really firmed up my view on this, that Netflix really shouldn't be able to just use theaters when it's convenient for them. So I don't know. I kind of get a little bitter when with this, but at least people will get the opportunity to see it if they so choose in a theater. But it's just them doing the minimum. So I don't know.
Yeah. For this one, it's like, if this was about some other Netflix project, I probably wouldn't care. But I'm a huge Rian Johnson fan, and I really love seeing his movies on the big screen. So the idea of like watching a new Rian Johnson movie for the first time on Netflix is pretty depressing to me. So I saw Glass Onion when that was in theaters for a week back in whenever that was, 2022, 2023.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I'll have the opportunity to do it again. But yeah, there are much, much larger issues at play here that we don't have time to get into in terms of like Netflix's relationship to theaters and all that. So, all right, last story here. Paramount is making a Call of Duty movie, which I was surprised by. I guess I shouldn't be because it's like a major franchise IP type of property that has a ton of name recognition. But there's a pretty big issue with that, and you wrote about this for the site. So tell me about the issue that Paramount is going to have to overcome here.
Well, I don't see it as it's all right. So let's first off, what it is, Paramount under the new leadership with Skydance, they made a deal with Activision to make a Call of Duty movie. There was one in development a handful of years ago that never really got off the ground. But now this appears to be like very seriously happening. David Ellison, the new CEO, is like actually an enormous Call of Duty fan. He plays them regularly, so he's really into this. The problem is, so the Call of Duty has a massive fan base. It's one of the biggest game franchises of all time. I believe the stat was they've had the best-selling game in North America for 16 years straight. Like, if wow. Whatever, it's crazy. So the issue is this. Call of Duty isn't one thing. It started out as World War II games, and then it's more modern warfare, all these things. There's zombie modes. There's Warzone, which is the more Fortnite-type game, and there's all these different things. There isn't, yes, most of the games have a campaign, but there isn't like specific characters throughout this entire series that you can hang your hat on. So the issue is that whoever is scripting this, whoever's directing this, whatever shape this takes, someone's got to figure out how to pull a narrative out of Call of Duty as it amorphously exists and make it not seem like a generic war movie, but also feel like Call of Duty. So like, it's a fine line to walk, but also at the same time, like, of course you try and do this, like with how popular Call of Duty is, and like a war movie executed well can make a bunch of money. And it's an easy concept to sell to people who don't even play the game. So I see the appeal of it. I don't quite know how you get the video game feel in there, but that's why I don't write or make movies for a living. But yeah, so someone will probably figure that out.
Have you played the Call of Duty games?
Yeah, so not like religiously or anything. Modern Warfare 2, way back in the day, I played the campaign, and there's this horrible level where you're kind of infiltrating this terrorist unit, and you have to go through an airport and essentially decide, like, do you just like kill civilians to blend in, or like there's this, it's like this horrible moral dilemma. And in all the years I played video games, that's always stuck with me. But then I've mostly just played a little bit online, and then they have the zombie mode, which is fun with friends and stuff. But, I engage with it here and there, but not like, there are people that like Call of Duty is when they say I play games, that's what they do. So I'm familiar with it, you know, on at a surface level. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wonder what the elements are that would satisfy the fandom, because I think you're right. I mean, when I think about adapting this into a movie, it just seems very difficult to me to imagine this being anything other than a typical or generic war story with the name slapped onto it. And I just don't know if there are any clear identifying factors involved with this franchise that the diehard fans would be like, oh yes, if it has this, then I'll be satisfied, you know? So that'll be interesting to see how people react, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I mean, I think that they could, you know, like, I think that Modern Warfare 2 campaign is probably the one that people have talked about the most over the years. So maybe you just try to adapt one of the campaign stories. You know,
That moral dilemma you mentioned earlier sounds like it could be an interesting cinematic scene. So yeah, maybe they just, yeah.
I think I'm butchering the specifics with it and played only, but yeah, that whole, but yeah, so I don't know. So maybe, but it's not an impossible nut to crack. You know what I mean? Like it's so, of course, Paramount doesn't have a lot by way of big franchises right now. So this is a smart thing to try and do.
Cool. All right. Well, that's it for the news. Thanks very much, Ryan. Appreciate it.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
With me now to talk about this year's Halloween Horror Nights is Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
Jacob, how's it going? How are you feeling?
I have a little bit of a cold, so if I sound weird, I apologize. But I got back from a whirlwind trip to Orlando, Florida. Universal Studios invited me to invited Slash Film down to visit this year's Halloween Horror Nights. Ben, are you familiar with Halloween Horror Nights? Have you ever been?
I've never been. I am familiar with it just from getting press releases for 15 years or whatever it's been at this point. But yeah, I've never actually gone. I came close a couple times, but I've never pulled the trigger on it. So what do you think about what this year has offered compared to years past? Because I know you've been before, right?
Actually, I'm a haunted house enthusiast, but this is my first Halloween Horror Nights.
Oh, okay, cool.
When I got the invite, I'm like, I'm not missing this. For those of you who don't know, Halloween Horror Nights is Universal Studios' annual Halloween seasonal event where for a few months in the evenings, they shut down the park and turn it into a giant haunted house complex. They have a number of haunted mazes, some based on movies and TV shows, some completely original. They have actors wandering around the park. They have weird food. And this is the 34th year of Halloween Horror Nights. They skipped COVID, and it's been the 1 year they missed. And so I finally get to go, and I just wanted to talk about it briefly because I had a great time, and it's one of those things where, like, it's kind of a bucket list item for horror fans, and this year was just an absolute blast. I had a great time, Ben.
Awesome. Okay, so yeah, why don't you run through some of the, what are they called, scare zones? Is that the correct term?
Scare zones are the public areas between attractions where various actors are walking around, you know, freely interacting with the crowds.
Okay.
The terminology Universal uses for their actual temporary Halloween attractions is mazes. But you know, you can call them a maze or a haunted house or a walkthrough attraction. I think all of those are accurate here. And there are 10 mazes this year, five of them based on existing movies and TV shows, and five of them completely original. I think usually like what the ratio is at Halloween Horror Nights. They try to do a mixture of completely original stuff with franchise-based stuff. I guess I'll start with the one that was most popular all night. I was there for opening night, so, you know, line fluctuations may happen. But the one with the longest wait all night, and I was fortunate enough to be, you know, with a press group, so we didn't have to wait in the line, so take that with a grain of salt. But the most popular house night by far, which was commanding 2.5 hour wait, long waits every moment I checked the app because I was curious, was Five Nights at Freddy's. Ben, and you and I think, are a smidge too old for the Five Nights at Freddy's fandom. I think it missed us barely. But this was, if you ever needed proof that this was like one of the biggest things on the planet, I mean, there were people who were devoting 2.5 to 3 hours of their 6 hours in the park to making sure they saw this maze.
That is nuts to me. I cannot imagine that. But maybe if you're like a, what is it called? A annual pass holder or something where like you can just drop in anytime, like maybe that makes more sense. But because doesn't the way that Halloween Horror Nights work is that like it begins at the beginning of September and it runs through whatever it is, the end of October, maybe early November or something. And is it every weekend or is it every night? Do you know?
I think it's every night. I know it's also a separately ticketed thing. Like I'm not sure how it works for pass holders, but I do know that walking around anecdotally, the express pass lines, which lets you wait in a shorter line, were essentially empty the night I was there. All the waits were from people who were standing in the standby line. So if you are planning on going, at least to the Florida version, like not speak to the Hollywood Universal version, however much it costs to upgrade to an express ticket, that's probably the key to seeing everything in one night. That's my advice. If you can't afford it, express pass is the way to go.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, why don't you run through some of the highlights for me?
Yeah, the Five Nights at Freddy's house was very cool. Like I said, I have no nostalgia for that. I think the movie is fine. I played one of the games back in the day. But this was a really impressive house. The Jim Henson Creature Shop, who built the costume, you know, robots for the movie, worked on this house. So you get the full-size evil animatronics. You get to see each character, you know, two or three times and like big close-ups, giant puppets, giant animatronics. It never felt half-assed. Like, that's the thing about Halloween Horror Nights is that nothing there feels cheap. And I find this at Freddy's house, without 8-foot-tall robots leering over you, would be a ripoff. I'm not so sure I would have waited 3 hours for this, But it definitely delivered on the, you know, giant robots who want to murder you story here going on here.
Amazing. Okay, so what about some of the other mazes that you saw?
Yeah, another a peculiar one was one called Jason Universe. And this is based in the Friday the 13th franchise, but they apparently weren't allowed to say Friday the 13th. They only ever referred to it as Jason Universe. And our guide very specifically, you know, referred to it as a Jason Voorhees house. And I think this has to do with the legal rights for Friday the 13th being so in such a legal cluster cuss right now. Mm-hmm. That from the looks of things, Universal had the right to use the Jason character, but not the Friday the 13th name. But so it's very peculiar. Listening to people like talk in circles around not saying Friday the 13th while discussing this house was a great inside joke for the night, to be honest. And this is a solid house. This is lots and lots of Jason is kind of the premise here. It's very much based on the early films of Jason Voorhees in this maze is. Pre-zombie, pre-space, pre-taking Manhattan Jason, you know, the redneck living in the woods who kills campers is very much the era of Jason this one focuses on. So this was the one like 80s throwback maze. Everything else was fairly modern, which is interesting. I feel like each year Halloween Horror Nights in the past has often like grabbed like, you know, a couple super old school classic slashers to lean on. Mm-hmm. But this was like the one serious throwback this year. But I enjoyed it. But also, I'm a big Jason fan. But you know, but probably not the biggest draw compared to, you know, some of the other titles here. But I'm glad that Halloween Horror Nights is, you know, going through the decades here.
Well, speaking of slashers, I know just from talking to you on Slack that there is a Terrifier themed maze. So, what was that like? Because it sounds totally insane.
Yes, Terrifier. It's one of those things where I'm continue to be. Really shocked by how mainstream this series has become, especially with its two sequels. Its first one kind of was only known as like a niche object to horror fans, and the sequels blew up. And Art the Clown, the like supernatural clown slasher killer from these movies, was all over the park. So, you know, they had walk around characters throughout the rest of the park, essentially like posing photos. It is surreal to walk into a Universal Studios gift store and see Art the Clown merchandise next to Hello Kitty stuff.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, this is for those who maybe are just joining us and haven't actually heard us talk about these movies, they are like the most extreme horror movies of the past several years, right? Like, that's probably fair to say.
That is fair to say. And one thing that our guy was talking to us about was how Universal has gotten some flack from certain groups of horror fandom over the years, but how, why is Halloween Horror Nights doing houses based on Ghostbusters, Beetlejuice, and Stranger Things, things that aren't like, you know, real horror, but are, you know, sort of horror adjacent. And he kind of joked that this was their way of proving them all wrong. And I will say this much, this is the most disgusting haunted house I've ever been in, not just in terms of visuals, but more tactile sensation. They pump horrible smells into it. There is a fork in the road where you have to choose if you want to exit dry or exit wet. And the wet is implied to be, I'll let you be the judge of that. And just every single corner of the, trying to find photos. Like, they let us take video, and we were screenshotting through the video trying to get good images for my articles. I have three articles up on the site. And trying to find any frames from the Terrifier house that we could use without violating company policy was nearly impossible. Like, it is by far the most depraved, disgusting haunted house I've ever walked through. And I've been through a lot. So anybody who ever wants to accuse Universal Studios of putting on kids gloves for Halloween Horror Nights just needs to do this one because if anything, it goes too far. But then again, like, if you're not going too far with Terrifier, what's the point?
Yeah. Okay. So what other IP-based mazes did they have on display?
One thing that took me by surprise is there's a WWE-themed maze. And I'm not a wrestling guy, so I went to BJ Colangelo, who is our resident wrestling expert on Slash Film. And this was she filled me in. This is essentially a group of characters called the Wyatt Six. That's spelled S-I-C-K-S, but implying, you know, but the number six as well. And they're a group of horror-themed wrestlers who, when they wrestled in Wade Bryant died a few years ago, he played, like, his wrestling character was, like, a supernatural cult leader. Slash, like, you know, demon haunted monster. And when he passed away, his brother, who's also a wrestler, formed this wrestling collective of additional horror themed characters sort of inspired by his legacy. So essentially, it's a haunted house where those characters are running amok backstage at WWE show and murdering everybody. And like I said, I have no attachment to these characters in any way whatsoever. This is a really impressive house. I got the gist of it very quickly. And perhaps because the performers here are like the characters they're based on are like really big, you know, performers designed to be seen in a wrestling ring. The actors are really going into it. Some of the best acting I saw in a Halloween Horror Nights house or maze this year were the actors here. They were like really chewing on the scenery. And once they realized that we were a press group who were filming the whole thing, they like completely started posing and posturing. It became like a gruesome horror pageant at one point. They were having more fun than any actor I saw all night. So you don't have to be a wrestling fan to enjoy the Wyatt Six. I think it's called the Horrors of the Wyatt Six house. I was genuinely really impressed by it, and I know nothing beyond the basics about those characters.
Amazing. Well, I don't want you to run through every single one of these because I want to encourage people to read your written coverage that's up at Slash Film right now.
One major IP one I did not mention, Ben.
Okay.
Fallout. If you have to skip one, skip the Fallout house. I'm a big Fallout fan, both games and movies, but this is the one dud of the bunch. So if you are going, if you have to make some choices, the other nine are worth your time, and I would recommend maybe missing Fallout.
Okay, so the Fallout one is your least favorite, even among the ones that are not based on IP, then. Is that right?
Yes. In fact, I have a ranking of all the houses up on slashfilm.com. I'd say as much as I enjoyed the IP-based houses, my number one was one of the originals. And I'd say in my top five, four of them were originals. So
wow.
as cool as it is that Universal gets the rights to these major names and recreates them, their team is so good at cooking up original stuff. Like they're telling real stories and like building indelible premises and having so much fun like doing original stuff. I feel like that's kind of the bait and switch, is you come for Terrifier, then you get won over by, you know, the other mazes, which don't have a recognizable name, but like have a wow factor because they're completely fresh.
Man, that's really cool. Good for them. I'm actually very happy to hear that, because it seems like it would be so much easier for them to just kind of half-ass, as you were alluding to earlier, like just like throw together something for their original stuff and spend most of their time and resources on the IP things to kind of like do right by that and attract those fandoms to come out and make sure everybody has like an immersive good time at those mazes, because that's probably where a lot of the attention is going to be drawn. But to hear that they actually care an equal amount about their own IP, if you want to call it that, is very kind of like heartening to hear in this day and age. So good on them. That's great. All right. Any closing thoughts, Jacob? Any like last minute tips or anything you want to give to people who might be trying to head out there for themselves?
Yeah, like I said, I can't speak to California, but the Florida version, if you are going, if you can't afford it, I can't recommend the express passes enough. They cost more, but the wait times went from the express lanes were empty, Ben. There was nobody waiting in them, whereas there were 3 hour long lines for 5 minutes at Freddy's. And like I said, most of their lines, you know, were generally under an hour. But even then, you know, I can't in good conscience recommend you travel out to Orlando, Florida, and, you know, get a hotel and get stationed and pay admission costs and then not see all 10 houses. So if you are making the trip, I recommend budgeting express. I also will say that we were allowed to sample a lot of the unique food offerings this year. And in true modern fashion, a lot of the food was more weird than good, like really, really designed to like be Instagrammable and be like, man, like you're going to eat that on a dare, as opposed to being necessarily delicious food. So I'm not saying don't eat the food, but I am saying be prepared for really strange food that you will probably want to try, but I can't necessarily promise it's going to appeal to everybody who puts it in their mouths.
Awesome. All right. Well, yes, be sure to check out slashfilm.com for Jacob's written coverage of Halloween Horror Nights. There's much more than what we talked about here. We just kind of scratched the surface. So cool. Yeah, that'll do it for this segment. Thanks very much, Jacob.
Yeah, happy to do it.
With me now to talk about The Roses is Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
Brad, what did you think about The Roses?
Ben, let me tell you. I really liked it a lot. I wasn't sure entirely what to expect. I actually haven't seen the original War of the Roses directed by Danny DeVito yet, but I love the trailer. I love the cast. It felt like it had been a while since we'd gotten a comedy like this. So I was really intrigued to see how it turned out, and I was very happy to see director Jay Roach return to the comedy world with a movie like this. It's really, really funny. The script is incredibly sharp and brutal with some of its barbs. Like, the shots that Benedict Cumberbatch and Olivia Colman take at each other as their marriage starts to crumble are just really hit hard, but they're also hilarious. And it makes for this, like, adult dark comedy, the kind of which that I feel like we haven't really seen in a long time. Because, like, we get R-rated comedies, but they're typically leaning into, like, raunchy stuff, and it's, like, higher concept stuff and, like, big set pieces. And this really just hones in on this relationship between a couple who once loved each other, had this charming spark, and then it slowly and gradually starts to fall apart, and they come to, like, have this hate for each other while still also being in love with each other. And just seeing that unfold is really funny and sometimes heartbreaking. And it has this incredible supporting cast around them too, including Andy Samberg and Kate McKinnon, that really adds another layer to, like, this group of where every couple is kind of dysfunctional in their own way. And I walked away being really satisfied and laughing a lot at this movie. So I dug it.
Excellent. Yeah, you touched on a lot of things there that I want to follow up on. So first of all, would you call this a comedy, a dramedy, or maybe something else entirely? Where does this sit for you?
I think the best way to describe it is a dark comedy, and dramedy would still also apply, because, well, that's actually one of my favorite things about the movie is Benedict Cumberbatch and Olivia Colman are such great actors that even in the moments when they, like, are delivering these really just, like, terrible insults at each other and doing despicable things to each other, they do it with such authenticity and genuine emotion that, like, you can see that there's sometimes a ping of pain after they've done what they've done. And at the times leading up to the full-blown crumbling of their marriage, they have moments where they seem to, like, recover, and, like, you feel the love between them, and there's a charm and this chemistry that is undeniable between them as a couple. So, like, there's a strong emotional core here, as funny as the movie is, and Cumberbatch and Colman really sell, like, that that genuine center of the movie. And that's kind of, I think, what makes the comedy hit even harder, is because you care about the characters and you like them, and you don't necessarily want to see them fail. And so when they're doing these things, as funny as they are, it also hurts a little bit.
Yeah, you're totally right about that. And I think that's maybe the biggest difference between this movie and the DeVito movie, which I watched in preparation for The Roses. And that film is so much darker and bleaker, and really, it's a much nastier movie. Like, the this film, The Roses, begins to escalate to a pretty heightened place by the end of the movie. And that escalation begins very soon in The War of the Roses, the film from 1989. So in that movie, as an audience member, you're not really interested in seeing if Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner are going to potentially be able to work their way through these issues. It's just kind of like you're sitting back and watching as they go to further and further extremes to try to destroy each other, basically. And so you don't really have that sense of hope that they could ever reconcile. And this movie, I think, does a much better job of being more realistic with it, but also giving you that sense of, like, maybe this could actually work. Like, these characters actually do harbor feelings for each other still. And the nastiness of that earlier movie just kind of makes you feel like, oh, there's actually no real remaining love between these characters. This is all just, like, kind of a ploy to get the house, and that's all they care about. They don't really have human feelings for each other anymore. But so yeah, I'd really be interested to hear what you think about that movie, because it's very, like, I guess structurally it's kind of the same. This is The Roses is, I would say, very loosely based on that original film. So there's a lot of differences in there, but I would love to know what you think about that. So if you get a chance to check it out, maybe we can talk about it again real quick. You mentioned Kate McKinnon and Andy Samberg. How did those characters work for you? Because Kate McKinnon in particular is kind of like on another planet in this movie. You know, she's like definitely doing her thing. And I think personally it walks right up to the edge of still working, but it's pretty close. And I feel like just one more percentage point on the dial or whatever you want to say, and it could have tipped the balance in a point where she would have just like completely broken the movie, I thought.
No, I agree with you fully there. And I think that speaks to just like her, both Jay Roach's skill as a director in keeping her reeled in, and also Kate McKinnon in being able to do that, but not push it too far. Because there are times where it feels like she's coming close to becoming a character in like a big studio comedy that it almost feels unrealistic. But I also do know a couple people who aren't too far removed from how she behaves as a person. So these people do really exist. But like, yeah, I think that's she's the closest the movie comes to like feeling like it's heading into like a, almost like a caricature area, but it never quite gets there. And I'm glad that they were able to like keep that tight and keep it like grounded without having her get too, you know, cause she's not zany. She's just odd, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I'm glad you also shouted out Benedict Cumberbatch and Olivia Colman in this, because I'm guessing the conversation around this movie is going to be like, wow, it's wild the things that these characters try to do to each other and just how far everything goes. And yeah, maybe the conversation about like whether or not they truly love each other and all of that. But I think you're right. In the quieter moments, that's what really makes this film work, is the fact that you have two of these incredible actors. I mean, I think Olivia Colman is like, I think everyone would agree that she's like truly, truly A-list, top tier, like one of the best performers we have, bar none, working right now. Benedict Cumberbatch is like not as great an actor, but he's still very, very good here. And I feel like he doesn't necessarily get like blown off the screen by her or anything. I think he holds his own, which is a weird thing to say about, you know, a guy who's led Marvel movies and things like that. But I just think that speaks more to Olivia Colman's talent than any lack of talent from Cumberbatch. But yeah, anything else you wanted to say about those two?
Yeah, I mean, Cumberbatch, first of all, this is the funniest he's ever been in anything. I was so impressed by his comedic timing and his way of bringing like an authenticity to the comedic side of the movie, in addition to, you know, we've seen him be skilled when it comes to drama and emotion and whatnot. And I do think that he is a great actor, honestly. I think if anything, he maybe just hasn't been given enough parts to like really show his range and true breadth of talent, you know, because I've loved him in stuff like The Imitation Game and Sherlock, and obviously roles as Doctor Strange. But I do think that he has a really respectable career as an actor, you know, even if he hasn't gotten the best parts. And Olivia Colman, I agree wholeheartedly. I think she's probably the British Meryl Streep, maybe would be the best comparison to make. And she's just incredible. But yeah, the way that they, like you said, the quieter moments, there are moments when like, especially like after they've successfully done something, like you can see like a little pang of like guilt or regret on their face that they're not fixing it, or that they hate that they've come to this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. All right. So before we get into your interview, you had a chance to talk to Jay Roach, the director, and then Tony McNamara, who's the screenwriter. He is behind movies like The Favorite and shows like The Great. Any closing thoughts on The Roses before we toss to that?
No, you know, I'm just glad that this movie got released. I hope people see it. You know, it's probably not going to be a big hit in theaters, but I hope people do find it when it comes out on VOD and, you know, eventually streaming, because it's very funny. And I think a lot of people, especially couples, will find a lot to relate to in this movie, even if it seems like it goes to a, you know, a darker, more absurd place than most relationships go. I think there's a lot of relatable things that happen in it, and people will see a lot of themselves in these characters.
Yeah. Well, real quick, before we go, you mentioned Jay Roach coming back to the world of comedy, and I think it might be instructive to just kind of walk people through some of his choices over the past few years, because like in the early part of this century, he was kind of like the guy making studio comedies. And in the past 10 years or so, he's really kind of strayed away from that realm. And this does seem to mark a return in some way. So what do you think about how he's evolved as a filmmaker and what you want to see from him next?
Yeah, it's really great to see him back in the comedy realm, because, you know, this is a guy who, he delivered the Austin Powers trilogy, he gave us Meet the Parents, you know, even if the sequels that followed that movie were not particularly good. That original movie is still, you know, a pretty great comedy. And, you know, when he went into the drama, you know, arena, he did a pretty good job with that, too. I think Game Change is a great movie. That's the TV movie with Julianne Moore as Sarah Palin. You know, Trumbo was a solid slice of Hollywood history. And, you know, and Bombshell also obviously did his job as well back in 2019. And so I think that, you know, he found a way to, like, keep making movies that interested him as comedies, especially at the studio level, kind of fell away. And I think that, you know, he did a good job carving out that little area for himself. And thankfully, this script from Tony McNamara came along and gave him an opportunity to tap back into it. Because I think The Roses does share some DNA with Meet the Parents as far as, like, the family dynamic and, like, the tension that exists between characters. And Meet the Parents is one of those movies that it's an adult comedy in that it's an entire family could watch it and you wouldn't really have a problem. But, like, it's the adults who will really relate to it and understand it and find it funny. And The Roses definitely plays on a lot of the same elements as that. But, and so I hope that this, you know, means that he'll get more opportunities to get into, you know, comedies and stuff like this. He's not going to direct what will be the fourth installment of the Meet the Parents franchise. Thankfully, I think it's better if he just produces and stays away and hopefully finds other things. But yeah, I hope that there's more comedy to come from him because he's really great at this kind of stuff.
Okay, well, here is Brad's conversation with director Jay Roach and screenwriter Tony McNamara.
So just to begin with, Jay, why was this the project that brought you back to theatrical comedy? Because for a while you were directing dramas like Game Change, Trumbo, Bombshell. What was it about The Roses that brought you back into this world?
Without blowing smoke, it was the script. I you know, was a little reluctant to do a remake, and I loved the first one, but that when I read the script, I go, oh, it's totally different and still got some of the same suspense and you know, dark, outrageous events, but hilarious. And also it came with Benedict and Olivia already attached. So it was an easy decision. They're both hilarious. I've followed their work for decades. And yeah, I just wanted to see what it'd be like to play with them.
Right on. Tony, what was the development process like writing the script, especially with Benedict Cumberbatch and Olivia Colman being executive producers, being attached? Did they help shape the characters in your script?
Yeah, between them and their teams, Adam and Ed, yeah, that was kind of and Searchlight. Searchlight kind of began the process. It was something they wanted. Olivia and Ben were kind of interested. And then we just started with this idea and a new idea for the take on the movie, which was like, how do people stay together rather than what happens when they break up? And then it was just this process of drafts and them talking to them about their characters and slowly just building the script, really.
Right on. Now, the movie feels exactly like the kind of comedy that we don't get from big studios anymore. Was it difficult to get the support to make it? I imagine that might be why there are so many producers and executive producers on this one.
You know, it was already had so much momentum by the time I came on. There's always last minute discussions about budget and, you know, can you pull it off and where are you going to shoot and all that stuff. But it seemed like it was meant to be. There was just a kind of gathering set of forces at play once you have such a great script and actors like Benedict and Olivia. I do think it does seem, unfortunately, rarer for comedies like this to get green light. And I hope it's part of a new trend, because I miss going back to the theater and just howling, you know, with strangers, you know, in the dark. So I hope we can get people back in.
Yeah, this movie balances such a tricky tone where it's sweet and touching and a bit painful one moment, but then hilarious and then still painful another moment. Is it fair to say that that's something that you don't have a full grasp on until you start seeing the performances?
You know, Tony had that tone in the script. I mean, I was just talking about the way the dinner scene worked out, which is a scene that as soon as I read that, I was like, oh, okay, I'm in. Because the Americans trying to imitate the British sort of banter and wit. But then in the very next scene, it's one of the darkest, most tragic, compelling things I've ever participated in.
Yeah.
So that wasn't the script. I could tell that just by the way Tony wrote it. Then throwing in cast like we were able to get, and already having Benedict and Olivia, but getting Andy Samberg and Kate McKinnon and everybody else that was in that great scene. That yeah, that's that that broadens your tonal capability quite a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Tony, what's your writing process like when it comes to figuring out what's funny on the page without seeing the performance? Do you have people that you rely on to kind of like test out lines? How do you figure out if a witty barb maybe goes a tad too far?
I don't really, I mean, I usually know I will have stuff that goes too far. And I rely on like once we hear it or and I think that's to do with tone, like Jay was talking about. It's like I try to just do what I kind of feel is funny instinctively. And then when you get on set with people who are really comedy, so brilliant at comedy, like Jay and and Andy and a Kate and an Olivia, you feel it and you can massage the tone a little and you can shift a line here or there to kind of keep yourself in a realistically truthful place, but still hitting the comedy really hard. So it's sort of doing it on my own for a while, and then it's the process of us collaborating as com because I think that's what I love about comedy is such a collaborative experience of being on the floor with people who really have good instincts, and you have good instincts, and it's how we just hone it all together, I guess.
So it sounds like you're not necessarily very precious about your dialogue, like some writers are known to be. You know, like you're open to improvisation and seeing what works on.
I mean, that's this a strong term, open. I mean,
You know what happened was people were so deferential to Tony because of how good his writing was. We did have some improv, especially with Kate and Andy, but far less than I do on most films, because people love that script and the banter and the
right.
dialogue was already so good. We always wanted to get that down. But the reason I loved having Tony on set all the time was when there were chances to play with something, they were trying things, but he was also folding it back into the writing. So there was live writing while there was also great improv once in a while.
Gotcha. Yeah, because it's the lines themselves, they hit so hard and they can be so brutal that they do feel like they have like a really firm calculation to them as to like when they need to hit and how hard they need to hit.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's how to balance. I think that's the trick of the tone, which was so fun to watch Jay manage that on the set, is it is like how we keep the truth of it and keep it super funny, but never feel like we've left the building and we're now making a farcy comedy.
Yeah, and I like that it has a gradual escalating build. You know, at first they're very sweet and supportive of each other. They have a little bit of tension here and there, but they work through it and they make up, and then it just starts getting worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, that was definitely part of the design. One of the new things we discovered in editing, though, was shifting some of that couples therapy up front, which that couples therapy scene is one of the funniest things I'd ever read in the script. And then they just nailed it. And the fact that they get each other so beautifully, they love their own sense of humor, even though they're saying the word, it is literally a list of 10 things they hate about each other instead of the 10 things they were supposed to write about how they love each other.
Yeah.
That was so set such a great tone that we moved it up to the front, and so you're always playing around with it. And Tony's script was very tight, but once in a while we discover something like that as we were playing it for audiences.
Yeah, I love that therapy scene because it kind of reminded me of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind in a way, where you have this relationship that feels like maybe these two shouldn't be together, but you also are rooting for them to work through it because you feel like they do match on some other level. You know, it's there's that toxicity, but then there's also that love that's still there.
Yeah, well, any comparison with Charlie Kaufman, I'll take.
Yeah, me too. I love that film. But that is what Tony brought to it too, is that you do hope they'll get it back together. It's almost like you think it might be a remarriage comedy, and some of Tony's dialogue is that kind of fast banter that those kind of films like Philadelphia Story or Adam's Rib. But you're also going for something that's as dramatic as like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf or something. So the script did that. It just went. It made you fear for their relationship and realize that wow, this might be doomed, but then, oh, hold on, they care about each other, they get each other, and what, how's that going to work out? And that kind of suspense, I think, is what distinguished it from the original.
Yeah, absolutely. Jay, you mentioned working with Andy Samberg and Kate McKinnon together, these two big SNL personalities as another dysfunctional couple. What was the process of working with them like, and what did they bring to the table, and how did it impact the script?
They are super collaborative as usual, and they got with Tony and I even in prep and talked through a lot some of the character ideas. They're brilliant character designers on top of the design that Tony already had. They were always looking to flesh things out a little more, and Tony wrote to their to some of their notes. And then there were times like at that dinner table and maybe another time or two where Kate's wildness, her mad poet brain would kick in and something else would happen. And then and Andy's so great at keeping it real, but he's such a kind of special ops of comedy guy. He thinks like a director. So I love working with actors who think like directors, because they're picturing how it's going to cut and how the tone is going to dial in. And so he was such a great counter to her. I love that relationship too, because they seem so screwed up and so unlikely to ever stick together, and then their love turns out to be the most permanent and stable.
Yeah, that was, I think, one of the best things is that the various couples you have, they all have their own brand of dysfunction, and you could almost like see a separate, movie that's following them, and then, that comes together, but with that big dinner scene, which I did want to talk about, that amazing, hilarious dinner scene. How difficult is it bringing something like that together? Because it seems like so much of it relies on the editing and cutting between all the different characters to really get that rhythm going and to make it pop.
Yeah, but again, Tony should answer that, because somehow it was so well written that it doesn't it definitely came together. But the design of it that was in the script, the way how intense the two leads were while everyone else is, going crazy. I mean, I'm curious how Tony, how what made you think that that would be funny watching Americans try to imitate fast banter of British people?
No, I think it just sort of happened. It was a piece I wrote. Like, I wrote the whole dinner scene in one sort of afternoon sitting, and it was because I pieced out there was a lot of sequences with lots of small scenes, and I felt like I wanted a really big scene, and I love dinner party scenes, and I'd love that kind of Who's Afraid vibe. And it just felt like a real culmination of the America English fish out of water thing and their relationship. So I think I was trying to find, because I'm an old playwright in a way, something that found a rhythm and sort of kept the audience tightly held for like 20 minutes through a sequence that took them, rather than piece it out as smaller scenes, because a lot of the movie is these smaller scenes. And I just wanted the audience to sit with them and the comedy and the dysfunction and the sadness all in one kind of three-act structure of like, three scenes kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the great thing about dinner scenes is everyone's trapped in one.
Yeah.
They can't
Yeah.
go anywhere. So everything that's going to happen, they're just going to have to figure it out and keep going.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
I love shooting to dinner scenes like that.
So in the press notes, producer Ed Sinclair said that there are multiple versions of this film that you, Jay, could have ended up cutting together, one of which could have been very Theo folk, sympathetic, another one that could have been very Ivy sympathetic. What was the process like of figuring out that balance in the editing room so that they both kind of had like an equal, responsibility of being not so kind to each other and but still loving, so that you weren't necessarily rooting for one over the other?
Yeah, I again that was by Tony's design, and once we cut it together, it was actually didn't change that much in terms of that balance. I love that the audience roots for one for a little while and then roots for the other and then occasionally roots for both and then occasionally doesn't is frustrated with both. But that was all built into the script.
I wanted to compliment. I think one of the stealthy best bits that's kind of like a runner throughout the movie is having the kids be so like mature about like just the things that they encounter, whether it's accepting like the fitness regimen or coming to understand that their parents probably shouldn't be together long before their parents ever do. And I just love like having kids like that who are just a little bit, wiser than their age.
I think kids are wiser than their age, and I think often, And I, yeah, so I think that's why I kind of liked the kids, and I liked that the Theo being sort of, well, it's also that unintended consequence. Theo's sort of acting out his own ego, making them athletes, but turns out they were meant to be athletes. So it's sort of this sort of nothing's quite as clear cut as anything, you know. And I do love the kids and their, and I do think if you're stuck with parents who shouldn't be together, the people who know it are the people living in the house with them.
Yeah.
So.
Were there any deleted scenes that you were disappointed to cut, even though you knew the movie probably benefited from getting rid of them in the end?
You know, there are very few deleted scenes. I was looking at the cards in our editing room the other day. We mostly just kept tightening. The film was already pretty tight when we even had the very first cut, and then it was just adjusting. You know, like we always talk a lot about how a film begins and a film ends, but I don't. There's not many scenes that didn't make it. They're just tighter versions of them.
Tony, earlier you mentioned that sometimes you do have a tendency to go a little too far with some of the insults and barbs. Are there any that you recall that you're like, okay, I gotta pull this one back?
I can't remember any off the top of my head, but it's pretty standard that I'll have some that should not be for public consumption. It's an occupational hazard of naturally going a bit far.
There was one scene, I just remembered one that we cut out that I always loved, which was when Benedict goes back to the bathrooms in the plane,
Oh yeah, I love that one.
the little kid says, you know, there's no conjugating, you know, at the, and he goes, one person can't conjugate to say you can't, but, and he goes, okay, but, and then he and the kid get into it in such a, he's so down and out that he has this really funny battle with this kid, and it was just one that, you know, that the pace of the film at that point just couldn't handle the diversion, but it was a really great, wonderful tangent.
Yeah, that's great. Well, they're giving me the light, so that's my time. Thank you so much, Jay, Tony. I love the movie, and looking forward to whatever else you guys got cooking in the future.
Thanks,
Thanks.
Arthur. Great interview. Thank you, man.
All right, Brad, before we wrap up today's episode, we have a part of a previous interview that we teased several weeks ago that it's finally time to play on the show. So, what do we need to know about the final segment of this Digman season two interview you did now that the entirety of that season is out?
Yeah, so basically at the end of this interview, I dug into some spoiler territory, talked about some specific jokes, a couple story plot points, including the very end of season two, the finale, which has, you know, one big spoiler. And we talked about, you know, what that meant for the potential future of the series and whatnot. So I just wanted to dig into some more specific things that was going to be a lot better to have on the show once people saw the full season. So now that season two is over, we can dig into it.
All right, here is the rest of Brad's conversation with Andy Samberg and Neil Campbell.
So, first of all, I want to compliment you on the don't tell the mom the babysitter's dead joke. Hilarious. And it felt like maybe an argument from the writer's room made it into the dialogue. Is that what
Yeah.
happened?
I think it was just me and Neil's argument.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it.
That was
Goes in
hilarious.
the
Also,
trailer. I'm so happy.
because we're Slash Film, I super appreciated the Eyes Wide Shut joke too about
Yeah.
Oh
the
Yeah, that was like their animators really nailed that too. Really copying the both the hand clap thing, but also the sort of hazy blue tint flashback. And
God, it made me
yeah.
so happy watching that for the first time. We were like, there it is.
Not even
Now,
flashback, fantasy.
in one episode, Rip offhandedly mentions his twin brother Zip,
That's
which
right.
Tim Robinson has the best response. Now, is that something that like has been discussed as like a potential storyline avenue or?
Yes, 100%. Yeah, and there's a little, it's
We've gone
twice.
back and forth where we're like it's there's maybe the funniest version of that is to just like throw it away super quickly like that and never revisit it, but then
Yeah.
also like I'm sure at some point it'll come in
Yeah,
handy.
there is another Zip. There's a little Easter egg Zip reference elsewhere in this season, but
Oh, is
people
there?
can keep their eyes open for it. Yeah.
Is it so I was wondering about that because I think it was in an episode that preceded it because you see three different Rip characters in the Bachelor episode, right?
Oh, when there's like our fake teases
Yeah.
that no, that's actually not
Oh,
it.
okay.
That's not it. But
Interesting. All
that's
right.
yeah.
I do love it when Rip in that same episode is frustrated because he'd be rather be speaking in his native Portuguese.
Yeah, we like adding little bits of biographical detail that we may or may not have any intention of ever justifying.
It. So I asked earlier about the sort of like having the less overarching details because I felt like I was tricked in a way, not in a bad way, but at the end of the Jack and Rose episode, you have that Avenger style Santa Claus tease. As, like, and I was like, oh, they're gonna be have some kind of ongoing thing with Santa Claus who's like gonna come after Dingman for some reason.
Look, I would say these are all we did a similar thing with Amelia Earhart at the end of her episode. So we have frequently teased that someone's going to come back, and just because it hasn't happened yet doesn't mean it won't. That's my
Well, but also we do think it's funny if it doesn't come back
of course.
to just use those like tag tropes because they're so dramatic and fun.
Yeah.
Now, have you guys started working on a season three? Are you kind of waiting in the wings to see what happens?
We're waiting to see if we get to do another season, and we're really hoping we do. And we love making it, and we have many ideas that well, I'm sure we'll many of which will get thrown away and get replaced by better ideas if we actually get to make it. But yeah, we'd be excited to, but we're not working on it at the moment.
If it doesn't, did you structure the end of this season that it would kind of function as a series finale in a way? Because even though that there's a kind of a cliffhanger with Rip being frozen, it would also kind of work as an ending and passing the baton on to Saltine in a way.
I think it would be hilarious if it was. Obviously, we don't want it to be, but
Course.
like,
That was always what we were saying. Yeah, it the way the season ends is would be so funny if that was actually how the show ended. But also, we have ideas for what could happen next.
Now, do you have any a wish list of guest stars that you would love to get on the show?
We do.
Steven Spielberg? Oh
Steven
gosh.
Spielberg. I mean, obviously we have discussed like is someday asking Nick Cage himself.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
But that's true of any project I'm working on ever. Just as a way to fold in Nick Cage, you're pretty much stoked. No one offhand. I think we kind of more take a character by character and then
Yeah.
decide who we think would be best for it.
That's fair. I actually thought it would be really cool to see Billy Zane pop up as the Phantom because it feels like it fits so well in this world. And Paramount did distribute that movie, so I think that maybe there's still an in
I
there.
know. We should have just had him for Titanic.
Would
Jeez.
love.
All right,
Always.
they're giving me the lights. Thanks a lot, guys. This was so much
Yeah.
fun.
Thanks so much. Good to see you again.
Andy, obviously, Quaid Army, Righteous Kill. I mean,
Righteous kill, my brother. Righteous kill.
Neil, thanks a lot.
Of
I
course,
love
yeah.
Dingman and hope we get to see more of it.
Thank you so
Thank you,
much.
man.
Take it easy, guys.
You too.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's show. You can find more of some of the stories that we mentioned on the show at slashfilm.com and linked in the show notes for this episode. You can subscribe to Slash Film Weekly on Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. We would love to hear from you. Make sure you leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show. If you haven't done that, we'd really appreciate it. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. We'll talk to you next week.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary, while supplies last, tax tip and fees extra, not available on third-party ordering platforms.